Well, good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you might be on this wonderful planet, and welcome to the creative field. My name is Jeannie Martin, and I am your host here on bbsradio.com every second Sunday night, 8 o'clock Pacific Standard Time, rain or shine, snow or sleet. The creative field is a program that offers creative solutions to a sustainable life on planet Earth, and to focus on what is possible, to learn from people who work hard to make things actually happen, to sustain and maintain a healthy natural environment that will support the life of our children and our children's children. And for those who care for the mind, body, and spirit aspects of all life on planet Earth. We are here on BBS because of our supporters, the Emissaries of Divine Light, British Columbia, and Edenvale Retreat Center in Abbotsford, B.C. Edenvale is a beautiful Oasis conference and retreat center in Abbotsford, where I'm lucky enough to be talking to you from right here tonight. So please check Edenvale out at www.edenvaleretreat.ca and check out our calendar of events that are happening year-round that the public is welcome to join us at. So before I introduce our special guest tonight, I would like to invite you to call in with questions or comments for our guest by dialing toll-free 888-627-6008. You can call in on that number from anywhere in the world, and your input is greatly appreciated and your thoughts are very valuable. So please feel free to call in whenever you have that inspiration. So without further explanation on the show, I would like to introduce our special guest tonight, Ted Koons. Ted is a psychotherapist in private practice in Vancouver, British Columbia, and is the author of the best-selling book, Peace Begins With Me. Ted is actively involved in his community, and he has been honored with numerous awards, including the 2005 Spirit of Community Award for Ability Awareness, and the 2007 Chamber of Commerce Award for Legacy Leadership. When his son Joshua acquired an uncontrolled seizure disorder at 5 months of age, Ted entered one of the darkest periods of his life. And after years of anger and fear, Ted had a life-transforming encounter with his son. And the result of that was an intensive journey to discover the source of peace and joy. So his book, his beautiful book, that I'm so blessed to have a copy of, Peace Begins With Me, is an inspiring summary of the wisdom that Ted has acquired on this journey. So I'd like to welcome our guest with great warmth and say hello once again, as I've run into Ted over the years in different places, and I'm always really glad to see him. So welcome, Ted.
Thanks, Jeannie. It's nice to spend this evening with you. And thank you for this program, for sending out these messages out to the world.
Well, I thought I'm actually not a very seasoned radio program host. This is only show number four, and my fourth time.
Well, good for you. And good for your courage to do this.
Thank you. So let's begin.
Yes, we've crossed paths a few times out at Edenvale. It's such a beautiful place you've got there.
Yes, and at different events as well. I've always been glad to see you. You know, Ted, when I think about you, I think you're definitely a one-man amazing movement. When I see you, I see you by yourself, and you're always... You're working so diligently and always promoting peace on Earth. Mm. So I'm really welcoming you to, you know, talk to us tonight and begin with how your journey began when Joshua got sick.
Yeah. Well, you gave the brief overview there. Josh was born healthy, and then at 5 months of age, his mother and I did what most parents do, is we took him to the doctor for his first vaccine shot, and Josh reacted to that shot and became quite agitated, and then over the next few weeks, his agitation grew, and eal it erupted into a grand mal seizure of about 25 minutes long. Took him to the doctors. They prescribed some medication, sent us on our way, and suggested to us that everything would be fine. I remember the doctor saying, just treat him as a normal child and everything will be fine. Well, unfortunately, everything wasn't fine. And a month later, he seized again, and then a month later again, and a month later again. And eventually, Josh's seizing increased in frequency, and by the time he was four, he was seizing 12 to 15 times a day, and each seizure was 15 to 20 minutes long. And a seizure of that length deprives the brain of oxygen and causes brain damage. And so the son of mine that at one point could walk and talk and feed himself and ride a tricycle, by the time he was four and a half, he could do none of those things. And so I watched my son, his capacity erode in front of my eyes. I was filled with anger and resentment about what had happened. The doctors had warned us that any one of the seizures had the possibility of killing him. And so every day I woke up and I lived in fear that my son would die in front of my eyes today. And it was a period of just intense fear and angst and suffering and resentment, and I finally got to a place where that level of suffering was just too intense. And I went to see a psychic, and I hadn't done that before, but I was looking for some answers. And the psychic gave me a beautiful message. She said to me, first of all, she said, do you have any questions? And my question that had been sitting in my mind for years was, will my son live? And there was this pause as she gathered her information, and then she answered. She said, have no fear. The son will outlive the father as he should. And when I heard that message, this joy went racing through my heart at the possibility that Josh would survive, and a second question came to mind, and that was, well, if my son is going to live, what will he be when he grows up? And again, there was that pause as she gathered her information, and then she said, your son will be what he already is, and that is a teacher. And I have to admit, when she gave me that message, it didn't make any sense to me. Josh's capacity had been reduced to about the level of a two-year-old. It required 24-hour care. And so the idea of him being a teacher, at least in the traditional way that I understood a teacher to be, didn't make any sense. But what I've since discovered is that Josh has been a beautiful teacher. He's taught me the most important things in life about acceptance, about forgiveness, about compassion, about seeing beyond this physical dimension. And I've learned things about peace and joy that I never imagined I would. And so today I'm absolutely grateful to have Josh as my son and to be his father and to have been on this journey.
I can imagine what a challenge that must have been to go through that process and to end up with that forgiveness. How did that happen for you, Ted?
Well, I had this moment of awakening, I'll call it, with my son, and it happened on a very typical day. Josh and I had shared this father-son ritual from the time that he was small. And it was a simple one. When we lived in a home in Port Coquitlam, which is a suburb of Vancouver, and we had a driveway alongside of the house and a carport at the back of the property. And so when I came home from work, I would drive up that driveway and park my car. And Josh would hear the sound of my car as it came alongside of the house, and he would know that Dad was home. And so he would run to the window that looked out under the carport, and he would greet me as I got out of the car. And as he got sicker and sicker, the number of times he was at the window got fewer and fewer because he was seizing or not well enough. And every day as I drove up that driveway, I would be filled with angst about whether he was well enough that day or not. Would he be in the window today or not? And on this particular day, I drove up the driveway, I parked my car, I looked to the window as I always did, and there he was in the window, and I can still see his face in my mind. He had this glow to him. He was just grinning from ear to ear, and he yelled, "Hi, Dad," and I said, "Hi, Josh." But I did something different that day. I just stopped, and I looked at him, and I just wanted to feel the gratitude that was inside of me at that moment that he was well enough that day to be there. But something happened when I was looking at Josh, and I don't know how to explain it, Jeannie, other than just declare what happened. And as I was looking at him, I heard this voice, and the voice was as if it was spoken out loud. And what I heard was actually a question, and the question was, "When your son looks through the glass at you, what does he see?" And I thought about that. Well, what does he see? And it seemed like that the truth was he sees a father who's angry. He sees a father who's afraid. He sees a father who's resentful. He sees a father who's in despair. And as soon as that truth settled in me, I knew that Josh deserved better than that. And I remember that day making a commitment to him. And I said, "Josh, I'm going to learn how to make peace with this. I'm going to learn to find my joy and my happiness again. I'm going to learn to fall in love with the son that I have, not the son that I don't have." And to me, that day was the day of transformation for me. It was a day that I began a journey of trying to figure out how to live life peacefully and joyfully, regardless of what life had offered me. And the truth was, I didn't know how to be peaceful and joyful, but that was the day that I made the declaration that I would learn. And what I did is I just began very simply by paying attention. I would look at myself throughout my day, at the end of my day, and I would ask, did I live in joy today? Did I live in peace today? Or did I give away my joy? Did I give away my peace? And I started to pay attention to what created the anger inside of me, what created the fear, what created the angst, what created the despair, and then conversely, what created the peace and the joy. And simply by being observant, I noticed that some ways of living life, some ways of thinking would add to my peace and my joy, and other ways would add to my fear and my resentment and my despair. And the bottom line of what I've learned is that I was responsible for all of it, that life simply showed up in all of its magnificence and all of its challenge, and it was me who decided whether to honor it magnificently or whether to decide that it was unacceptable, or it was me that assigned the meaning to life. It was me that told the story about what was in front of me. And I learned to tell better stories. I learned how to receive the gifts of life, even when at the moment they didn't look like gifts.
Well, you know, as I hear you speaking about this, and I was thinking about you today as I was coming home from my office, and thinking about how when we talk about peace, peace on earth, I think a lot of people think, well, we'll have peace if the bombs just stop dropping. Mm-hmm. But what they don't realize, I think, is that the peace, before those bombs drop, there's a lot more steps before that, and it goes right back into the inner peace of who we are, how we feel about ourselves and the people in our worlds and our interactions. Do you agree?
Jeannie, that's exactly it. I mean, I had the same perception. My belief system was that peace would happen when presidents and prime ministers and whoever made better decisions. And so when we didn't have peace, I was angry at people like George W. Bush. I was angry at people that seemed to be making the wrong decisions. And my idea was, or my story was, if only they would be different, then we would have peace. And what I've since learned is that I don't believe peace is going to happen on the outside when it doesn't exist on the inside first, that our task is to learn how to be peaceful beings first, and then when we come from a place of peace, we will create a peaceful world. And so that's where the title of my book came from, Peace Begins With Me. It doesn't begin with George W. Bush. It doesn't begin with somebody else. It begins with me. And what I realized is that I had spent much of my, probably the first 40 or 45 years of my life giving away my power over my peace and my joy. I acted as if somebody else had to be different first. It's one of the ideas that I recognize in my paying attention to how I was living my life, and it's one of the ways that I recognize that I would create anger or fear or sadness. And the idea was that I would say to myself, I'll be happy when. I'll be happy when somebody does something different. I'll be peaceful when. I'll be joyful when. I'll be loving when. I'll be generous when. I'll be forgiving when. But all of that was dependent upon somebody else doing something different first. And when I began to recognize that that way of thinking, that way of living, was actually giving away my power, that was a huge awakening for me to learn that I can be peaceful now in this moment with exactly the way life is. As a matter of fact, by being peaceful, I actually am a more powerful agent of change than when I'm in a place of resistance. And so that was just one of the awarenesses that I came to, that I needed to create it inside of me first. I needed to come from a place of peace or joy or acceptance or forgiveness if I was going to be able to create it in my outside world.
Yeah. And, you know, I imagine, too, that as a psychotherapist, you're dealing with people all the time that are looking for peace within themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? Yeah.
Well, most people don't present it that clearly. They would say they're looking for happiness. What I've learned is that I actually don't think that most of us place peace very high in our list of priorities. I think that we place many other things higher than peace. We place fairness, we place comfort, we place being right. Higher on our list of priorities. And so I look at the world and I say, well, the world is a reflection of our value system. And when we do place peace as our ultimate value, I think that we'll be living in a world of peace. But right now, we prefer other things first, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. It makes a lot of sense. I hear you completely. Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the questions, Jeannie, that I often ask clients that I work with is I say to them, before we begin our work, I need to ask you a very simple question. Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And what I've noticed is many people would rather be right than be happy.
as kind of off the wall that sounds, it can be so true. And because I'm sure that anyone who's listening tonight may have been in that position where they wanted to be right rather than be happy. But when you phrase it that way, then it gives us the opportunity to look at that question.
Well, and it looks pretty insane when we realize how easily we give away our happiness.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, Ted, I'm always enjoying your newsletter, and if other people can go on your website and join your newsletter, you've got some wonderful, wonderful articles that you write. And one of them that touched me particularly in this past month was talking about the red poppies.
Hmm.
And then, of course, being connected with those that were wearing white poppies.
Yeah.
And white poppies signifying peace.
Yeah.
Red poppies reminding us of war. And that's not to diminish or unappreciate anyone who stood in and went to war for whatever reasons at the time. But I think it's time to shift our consciousness in a whole different direction. You can't be anti-something. You have to be for something.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
Yeah. I mean, the poppy thing has been an issue for me that I've been conflicted about for years, and I've actually written about it a few times now in the month of November when I do my monthly newsletter. And for me, the poppy somehow has been, I think, co-opted as a way of supporting war in a way that I think is not in our highest good. And you know, when you interview the veterans of war, they're the first ones to say that war is insane. To me, war represents the failure of the human condition to deal with our challenges as global beings in more civilized ways. And one of the questions that I ask is, what are we being asked to remember on Remembrance Day, and what the kind of response that I got to my newsletter told me that I really touched a nerve, because some people felt that I was being quite sacrilegious even to ask the question. But I think that we really need to examine our core beliefs in our society. I mean, people also chastise me saying that I'm being naive in talking about peace, that given the human condition, it's not possible. And I think, well, if we can't even hold it up as a possibility, how are we ever going to get there? I believe it's a possibility. What it requires, it takes courage, it takes intention, it takes responsibility, and it means that I have to, as I said before, I have to make sure that I'm being a peaceful person first. What I witness is most of our attention is focused on somebody else being different. You know, if only, Mr. Saddam Hussein will be different, or Mr. George W. Bush will be different, then the world will be different. And all I know is the only power I have is what's inside of me. And one of the authors that I speak to in my book that I share is Byron Katie, who wrote the book Loving What Is. And one of the gems of wisdom that I gleaned from her writing was where she talks about there being three kinds of business in the world. And the three businesses are my business, your business, and God's business. And she says that when you're in a difficult situation, the first question you should ask is, whose business am I in? And she says, if you're in somebody else's business or God's business, you're in trouble. And I think I spent most of my life in other people's business or God's business, and I neglected my own business, which is my joy, my peace, my happiness, my behavior, my actions, my intentions.
Yes, and some time ago, I think it was some kind of program that was being put on to address people's unwillingness to change, even if our life is looking like it's a catastrophe. Rather than change it, people have a tendency to stay in that vibration and what they know, to be afraid to step out and do something different and get different results. Yeah. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, it's a good question, Jeannie. I mean, you know Einstein saying about insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I, humorously say is that I work with many insane people in my day-to-day practice. But the other part of it is that, you know, what I have a core belief that we all do the best we can with what we know. And I think, unfortunately, that our level of consciousness hasn't taught us to take more responsibility for the life that we've created. We act as if somehow life happens to us and that we're victims of this world, as opposed to that we collectively co-create this experience, and if we don't like it, let's create something else. See, I believe that ultimately we're creative beings, that we have the power to create. I have that painting on my wall, both at home and at work, actually, of Michelangelo from the Sistine Chapel, where the hand of God is extended to the hand of man. You know which one I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm, yep.
And the title of that painting is called Creation. And I don't know what Michelangelo had in mind when he made that painting or when he titled it that, but the meaning that I take from that image is that something very important is being transferred from God to man in that image. And Michelangelo has captured that. And I believe what man is being given is the power to create. That when the Bible says that we're made in the image and likeness of God, I don't know that that necessarily means we look like God, but I think what it means is that we too can create like the great creator. But I have to admit that for the first 40 or 45 years of my life, I didn't live as a creative being. I lived as a reactive being. And so something would happen, and I would react. Something else would happen, and I would react. And it's only in the last 10 years of my life that I have recognized that I have the power to create. And creation begins with intention. And so what do I want to create now? Given what is, what would I like to create? What's my intention? And I think most of us don't embrace the power that we have as creative beings. I think that we have been trapped in a consciousness of reactivity. I think that we've been inundated with messages that teach us that we're not very powerful when in fact we are. We have a victim consciousness on the planet. There's a friend of mine by the name of Ray Willem who says there's a disease on the planet that he says is an epidemic. And he calls the disease victimitis, where we act like we're victims.
Right. You know, I also work with clients, and I tell them that as we begin our path in life and we walk along that path, and at a certain point, that path takes a V at the end of the road. And one road goes down victim, and the other road goes down wisdom. Mm-hmm. And we have a choice. I mean, I'm sure that anyone, I mean, I'm a grandparent now, so as I look back mm-hmm. over my life, I can truthfully say that I learned a lot from what not to do.
Yeah.
But that's the bottom line to it, is that I learned something.
Yeah.
So that no matter what anyone does, I mean, we can look back and go, oh, man, I wish I hadn't done that. Or this could be different, or that could be different. But where has it brought you today? Are you going down the track of wisdom, or are you going down that road of victim? And it is a choice. It truly is a choice.
Well, and again, I agree with you, and yet I think many people don't even recognize they have a choice.
Yeah.
You know, many of the people that come to see me for counseling, they are more focused on somebody else, and part of my work with them is helping to shift their focus so they begin to look at themselves. How have they created the circumstances being the way they are? What can they do that's different? How can they stand in their power? Where have they given away their power? And those are uncomfortable questions because we would much rather focus on somebody else about how somebody else needs to be different than to look at our own contribution to the crises that we're in or the suffering that we're in. But to me, if I collude with them that it's about somebody else, I'm going to keep them in a place of powerlessness that doesn't serve them.
I agree, and I had a guest not so long ago, and he was speaking about our need to have emotional maturity.
Mm.
Because we have come to a time that no matter what, like you were saying earlier, what our story is,
yeah,
what can we do today as co-creative beings? I completely agree with your perception on that. I totally believe. And as I'm very interested in quantum physics, because mm-hmm. that absolutely shows us that we yeah. are co-creating this reality.
That's the fascinating stuff, isn't it? Science is now beginning to catch up with the impact of the observer on experiments, and simply the intention or the thought of the observer changes the outcome, doesn't it?
It does. You know, I've got a little bit of a metaphor that I remember just briefly when I was a young person. We were teenagers, and we were walking in a train tunnel that was jet black. And we lost one of our friends. She fell and tripped on the tracks, but we couldn't see her. And so we heard her yelling because we knew the trains were coming back and forth on that track in that tunnel. And we couldn't see her, and the vibration didn't tell us where she was either. And I reached it. It was so black, Ted, you couldn't put your hand 2 inches in front of your eyes, you couldn't see it.
Wow.
And I reached into my pocket, and I felt this package of matches. I lit one match, and held it up in the air, and that lit up that entire blackness. We saw her. She was there.
Yeah.
But that, to me, all my life has been a metaphor. It only takes one spark of light to dispel so much darkness.
Yeah.
So when a person says, what can I do all by myself? You can do a lot.
Absolutely. To me, we can be an example to others about how to live life different, how to take responsibility for our thoughts, our feelings, and our behaviors. How to set a higher intention. I mean, to me, that's what Jesus did. Is Jesus was a role model of another way of living life, another way of being on this planet.
Yes, absolutely. And now that I have, what really concerns me today is because, you know, I don't know about you, but I was a teenager in the 60s. So at that particular time, we were talking about peace and love and all sorts of things, and we've been talking about peace now for all those years.
Yeah.
And do you feel that we're any closer to it?
You know, I guess maybe I am an eternal optimist, or maybe I'm naive, I'm not sure, but See, I believe that the experience that we've gone through is what is part of our journey of learning how to embrace the responsibility. So it may look like we've gone backwards. I don't really believe we can go backwards.
No, I don't either. I don't believe we do. We can. But I'm wondering what we could do now that's new, because lip service is cheap. I see you doing so much work on behalf of peace. I know. You're everywhere.
Well, see, to me, I feel like I'm just one person, but what I believe that I've done is that I'm having the courage to speak about it. I'm talking about my responsibility for it. I'm acting as a powerful being as opposed to somebody who thinks that they aren't very powerful. I believe that all of us are like radio stations broadcasting a signal, and I want to make sure that the signal I broadcast is a high enough vibration. Are you familiar with the map of consciousness that was put together by David Hawking?
Yes.
And so he rates thoughts, perceptions, emotions on a scale between 0 and 1,000. And things like peace is, I think, around 600 on that scale. Anger is probably around 50. Resentment, shame is around 20. And what he says is that anything under the vibration of 200 is destructive. Anything above 200 is creative. And the challenge that we face is that the human condition in general is vibrating at about 175 level. And so what I've learned is that if I'm not conscious, if I'm not intentional, if I'm not vigilant, if I allow myself to be seduced by the consciousness that's around me, I can be lower to a destructive level. You know, what I do is I don't read newspapers. I don't have a TV in my house. I am very careful about the kind of messages that I allow to be sent to me. You know, it's like what I say is that the whole world is a story, and I want to make sure that the stories that come to me or are told to me are stories that will lift my consciousness. Unfortunately, there's far too many stories out there that are destructive. I mean, just turn on a TV set, and we're inundated with stories of shame and anger and fear and resentment, all those things that are vibrating at less than 100.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's why this program is happening, and BBS Radio is doing a very good job of encouraging people along those lines to start saying what's right with the world and what can be done. I am an optimist. I'm a total optimist, and because I believe in the co-creative principle, doesn't mean that I've gotten rid of all of my judgments or my unpeaceful little hidden corners.
Well, they'll show up. If they're there, they'll show up. And you know, what I've learned to do is I've learned to invite them to come up so that I can see them and I can heal them and I can transcend them. And so when those moments happen, I say, okay, you come out of that little dark place. Let me take a look at you. I want to see what story I'm carrying around that's not serving me.
Yeah, because those kinds of stories are very heavy on the heart, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's almost like when we carry around inside of us resentment, and some of us, we carry it all our life, life, that over something that might have been 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. And so there's this idea that you have to, in order to break free of that, you have to forgive everybody. Well, there's a difference, isn't there, about letting something be free from your heart. It happened. It was a reality. But how would you tell people to release some of those things, just like you did with Josh?
Well, again, you know, one of the Jeannie, I've worked with people, as I'm sure you have, who have done, you know, the range of behaviors that humans can do. I've worked with people who have murdered. I've worked with people who have raped. I've worked with people who have abused their children. And what I do is that I say to them, tell me your story. How did you get to a place where that behavior became possible? And what I've learned is that when they tell me the story, the behavior makes sense. I understand how they got there. It's a natural extension of the lives that they've lived, the belief systems they've been given, the skills or lack of skills that they were given as children. I mean, one of the metaphors I use is I say we all do the best job we can with the tools in our toolbox. The challenge of life is that we're born with an empty toolbox, not a full one. I don't know anybody who says, I could do a better job, but I'm going to go mess up over here with my wife or my children or my community. What I believe is that many people don't have the skills that allow them to live life joyfully, peacefully. I didn't. I had to go looking for them. I had to intentionally experiment with life, make sure that, I would pay attention each day about, is what I'm doing, does it add to peace, to joy, to happiness? At the end of my day, I would review my day and say, where did I give away my joy? Where did I give away my peace? Where did I carry anger or resentment? What story did I carry that I need to take a look at? And to me, that kind of vigilant self-examination allowed me to begin to root out the darkness. It allowed me to begin to identify ways of living life that were more effective. But most people haven't had the luxury of being guided or taught. If anything, what I say is that, unfortunately, I think we're taught how to be angry or afraid or resentful. We're taught that much more commonly than we are taught how to be peaceful or joyful in this society of ours. And so, yeah. You know, my work is taking what I learned and trying to share it with others. And, you know, when you ask me about do I think that we're learning, what I can tell you is that when I began to share this work, I started in 1999, and the way my book actually came about is that I was invited by a colleague who works with businesses, with corporations, and he called me up one day and said, Ted, you know, I'm working with a client where there's a lot of stress in the workplace. Do you think you could throw together a workshop on stress management for me? I thought, well, geez, what do I know about stress? Well, I had all these notes that I had made about my own journey, and I realized there were some really good ideas in there, so I began to organize them, and I started to share this, and people liked what they heard. It resonated with them as simple but powerful strategies, and they would ask me if I would write about it because they wanted to learn more. But when I would go into these corporate rooms with these people with suits and ties on, and I would think, oh, geez, you know, what are they? They're just going to tell me to go, because peace is not, you know, it's too soft an idea. It's not relevant in their world. And much to my surprise, people were hungry for it. They embraced it. They, if anything, they wanted to learn more about that. You know, my colleague used to market my workshop to corporations, but he would call it the joy of stress, and he would tell the CEO or the executive director that it was a stress management tool. But I would come in, I would talk about peace. And one of the CEOs came up to the two of us after one of my workshops, and he said, okay, I got you guys figured out. He said, Ted, no offense to you, but if you came into my office and said, I got a workshop on peace, he said, I never would have bought it. But he said, Ross comes in, says, I've got a workshop on stress management. Of course, that's what I need. I sign on the dotted line. Then you bring Ted, and he talks about peace. Now, he said, that's exactly what we needed to hear. We just didn't know we needed to hear that.
Oh, that's wonderful. What would you tell young people today? I've got 7 grandchildren. 6 of them are teenagers. They're in a place of limbo. They look at the world. They don't really know where they're going. And what would you say to a young person in their teens, perhaps, or preteens, as they go into the world, how to stay peaceful, how to... Yeah.
See, you know, to me, I look at the world today and the amount of change that's happening, and some people look at that and they move into a place of fear and they get paralyzed by that and they can't move forward. I look at it and I say, we are at a time of incredible transformation. We are at a time of incredible creativity. And the metaphor that I like to use is the metaphor of the caterpillar becoming a butterfly. Mm. And there's a stage in that development where the caterpillar goes into that cocoon, and he actually dissolves as a caterpillar, and he's in this state of gush, of mush, of nothing. Now, it would be easy for the caterpillar to think, oh my God, my life has come to an end, there's nothing good that's going to come out of this. But what we know is that there's a divine intelligence that's there that allows this butterfly to emerge that's far beyond what the caterpillar could ever imagine for itself. And what I say is that we all have that divine intelligence if we trust it, that we are in the process of becoming butterflies. Now, many of us don't recognize that we think we're alone in this journey. We're not alone. You know, we're part of a higher divine intelligence. When I go to speak, you know, I know that what comes out of this mouth doesn't belong to me. Before I speak, I say to the higher universe, I say, guide me in this opportunity here. Allow the words that need to come out to come out. Allow the message that needs to be heard to be spoken. And, you know, Jeannie, I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth in 2 seconds. This isn't a script that I've got. What I've learned is get out of the way, allow the intelligence that's there to come through.
That is incredible advice for all of us, is to get out of the way. You know, when we think about the way that we think, we're, people's heads are almost tied in knots now because they're thinking. When I think whoever said that trip between the head and the heart is the longest journey on earth, that's where we need to come from. And things like heart math are showing that as well. That our beingness, our brain, if you want to call it, is in our heart, not in our head.
That's right. Well, that was the, I remember the story they told when I went to that heart math presentation about how they had gone into Tibet or wherever it was, and they wired up these yogis to record their brain waves. And the yogis, or, you know, the Tibetan people that were watching this happen started to laugh. Do you remember? Did you hear the story?
Yeah,
I
do.
And they said, well, what are you laughing at? And they said, well, you've wired up the wrong part of the body. You've wired up the brain. You should be wiring up the heart, right?
Exactly.
It's like these Western people don't know where their intelligence comes from, right?
Exactly. I don't know. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, this idea of the intelligence, I learned that from Eckhart Tolle, who talks about the power of now being in the present moment. And I can remember one of the speaking engagements I went to where Eckhart was speaking, and you know, Eckhart made a comment about how people will call him the day of that he's going to speak and say, "Well, Eckhart, what are you going to talk about tonight?" And he says, "Well, I don't know till I get there." In one of the evenings that he was presenting, you know, we all were sitting in the audience, and Eckhart sat down, and then there was this silence for about 10 minutes, and finally somebody yelled out loud and said, "Eckhart, why don't you speak?" And he says, "Well, I can't speak until the words come." And what he basically says is the words emerge out of the silence. He said, "I just need to create the space for the intelligence to come through." He said, "I don't arrive here with a speech." And when I heard that, I realized, and I was always in awe of the level of wisdom that he would communicate. And it gave me the courage when I began to speak, not to come with a prepared speech, come with an intention. What's my intention? But allow the words to emerge in the moment. You know, sometimes I get you in trouble, Jeannie. I was invited to, at an event where Stephen Harper came. And I was the master of ceremonies for the event, and the Prime Minister's office wanted my speaking notes before they would let me come on stage. And I, you know, emailed back where they said, "Well, I don't have speaking notes." "Well, you need to have speaking notes because they need to be approved by the Prime Minister before you can do this." So I had to make up something so they would let me on the stage.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, man. You know,
that's politics for you, is that it's a scripted message. It's not the wisdom of individuals.
Yeah. It's like, too, you said earlier about having the courage to make those changes.
Yeah.
It seems to me that some of us are worried about, if I make a change, then that makes a domino effect all the way through my life. And that might change my relationship with this person or that person, or you know what I'm saying there. It does take courage, and it takes courage to make that commitment.
Yeah. Well, it's true, because when you're right, is that when you begin to wake up, things start to change in your life. You might decide that the relationship you're in is no longer in your highest good. You might discover that the job you're in is no longer in your highest good. you might decide that you have to let go of some things that you've been holding on to. And to be willing to let go of our attachments to those things does take courage, because we think that that's where our security is, but it's not.
No. And money, any amounts of money, we've all known people in Hollywood even who've been very, very rich and very, very unhappy. So this ladder that we think we're climbing goes to nowhere if it isn't in your heart. If you don't have the peace within and the knowledge, like you said, that you're a divine creative being, way more than you think you are.
Well, I remember watching this interview or listening to this interview of this man from Russia who had been a millionaire 11 times and lost his millions 11 times. And the interviewer said to him, "Wow, yeah, that must have been awful." And he said, "Oh," he said, "you have the impression that it's better to have a million than not." He said, "the truth is they're just different experiences, and I enjoy both of them. And so one's not better than the other." Well, that's a very different way of being in the world than we've been taught, isn't it?
Oh, is it ever?
Yeah.
And, you know, particularly now, as we come into what appears to be financial difficulties a lot of people are facing, you know, I have a the way I look at it is that the system isn't working. It has to come apart anyhow. But where do we go together? And this gives us a wonderful opportunity to think it up brand new.
See, what I've learned is that things have to collapse in order for us to recreate something new.
Yeah.
You know, most people don't easily let go of something. They let go when it no longer works, when they're suffering enough. And so I've learned that there's gifts in suffering. You know, when I first began my private practice, it would be very difficult for me to witness people that were suffering, and I was always in a hurry to try to get them to stop their suffering. And what I've learned is that the greatest or the richest moments in my life with my son were the greatest opportunities for developing wisdom. And so what I say now is that suffering is the gateway to wisdom. And so when people come into my office and they're suffering, I say, "you are on a journey here to something quite deep and profound. Are you willing to be open and receptive to it? Can you trust that it's coming to you?" And so I'll talk about the gifts of darkness. Now, lots of people initially think you're crazy when you talk like that, but I'm willing to be considered crazy. But what I've learned is that when you ask the question, "what do you think is the gift in this experience you're having right now?" that they start to look for it, because you planted a seed and their mind begins to look for that gift, and they invariably come back and say, "Ted, when you first asked that question, I thought there was something wrong with you, but you're right. There are some valuable gifts that I've learned as a result of this journey."
Yeah, and I, you know, since I've been blessed to move to Edenvale, I'm a city girl, and I was raised in the city. I was born and raised in Vancouver, and it's not too many of us.
No, you're unusual.
Yeah, and now that I've had a chance now to come out to the country and put my feet down on the ground and feel the energy of Mother Earth and to look at these cute little birds that live here all year long and be a part of that, I don't know how to explain what that feeling is, getting off the concrete and standing on the ground.
Yeah.
It's not a step backwards to move away from all the high-tech stuff that surrounds us.
Yeah.
In fact, it becomes amazingly wonderful to the heart and the body to be able to walk out and just take a moment and look around.
Well, you know, it's that I've got a plaque in my mantelpiece. I can see it from here, that phrase that says, "be still and know that I am God."
Yeah.
And what I see is that sometimes in our urban life is that we're so busy that we're like spinning tops. There's no opportunity to stop and pause and simply listen to the wisdom that's inside of us. There's no stillness, and the beauty of where you are is that there is those moments of just placing your feet on the soil, and it grounds you in the moment, and you begin to be filled with that stillness.
And that is the time when you can, I don't know how many of us actually take the time to stop for a moment and say, "well, how are you doing, Jeannie?" Mm-hmm. Where are you at now on your path? Mm-hmm. And to look inside and check in and say, how am I doing? When I was a kid, we'd have a cup of coffee, and it would be black or cream or sugar. Now it's cappuccino, frappuccino, latte. You can't even have a cup of coffee without having to decide of 30 items on the board. So everything has become, we think technology is helping us. I think that a lot of this is confusing us because the mind can't cope.
Well, and I agree, it certainly can. I mean, on one hand, I want to say that those experiences are rich experiences. You know, the kind of cappuccinos you can have are delightful. But if it means that you have to have that standard all the time, we could spend a lot of time in suffering, as opposed to say, let me enjoy the cappuccino, let me enjoy the coffee that's black, let me enjoy the water, let me enjoy whatever's in front of me, because that's the experience that's in front of me right now. What I realized, I spent most of my life either in the past or the future. I was rarely in this moment. And what I've learned is the only place life exists is right here in this second. But again, probably in the first 45 years of my life, I spent most of it either reminiscing about the past or imagining a future. And most of the future that I imagined was a negative future. So it's not surprising that I was suffering. But I learned, even with the sun that's seizing, in this moment, even while he's seizing, if I simply hold him, I stroke his forehead, I whisper to him while he's seizing, I can manage this moment. It's entirely manageable. What's not manageable is the story that I've got in my head about the way it's going to be in 2 minutes or 5 minutes or a year. Because I can't manage that because it doesn't exist.
No. No. And I guess, too, there is a bit of a difference in having a vision as we co-create towards what we feel in our hearts is a higher vibration.
Yeah.
But to be locked on the outcome and the way that it's going to manifest is when we get back into trouble again. It's having that faith and letting it be what it is, like you were saying earlier.
Yeah. Well, it's like with my son. What I say is that I've learned that I can hold hope that his medical condition will be different than it is, and I can accept who he is and his medical condition right now at the same time. I can hold hope and acceptance at the same time. And I didn't know that before. I thought that the only way I could have hope is that I had to not accept what was happening. But acceptance is a powerful way of being in the world. I used to think acceptance meant that things would never change. What I've learned is that in a paradoxical kind of way, when you accept something, you ask the next question, which is, so given it is what it is, what will I do about it now? You actually become a more powerful agent of change when you accept something than when you resist it.
Oh, isn't that true? Absolutely. And what you give power to is what expands.
Yeah.
True?
Yeah,
absolutely.
But we spend all kinds of time in resistance. Well, that should never have happened. Well, it did happen. And so given that it did, now what are we going to do about it? In this moment, how can I stand in my power in this moment and be an agent of change?
Absolutely. And that's another reason why we're on this program right now, is to tell people and share with them that anything can change, anything at all. And we can imagine it up and think it up and be together and love it up in a myriad of different ways than it is now. One thing we know for sure, we know what doesn't work.
Well, and I think that's probably what some of this journey has been, is figuring out who we're not.
Right.
Figuring out what doesn't work, because that's part of what we need to figure out as well. I mean, that's what I say to my kids, is that when they're having experiences and they experience some of the challenges of life, I say, well, now you learned a little bit more about who you're not or what doesn't serve you, right?
Exactly. And also, it's a time to embrace that, not just ourselves, but we are truly a brotherhood. I'm looking at a piece that you have on your a newsletter written by Martin Luther King. It was part of his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech. And if I may, I'd like to just read it. It says, I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have three meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Well, and that's what he did. He dreamed a bigger dream than we were living at the time. You know, and so Martin Luther King is one of those powerful beings. So is Gandhi with his vision that he had for India. You know, I love that part of in Gandhi's journey where he said to the British diplomat that it's time that you left India, and the British diplomat says, "Well, you know, how are you going to make us leave? Where's your army?" And he said, "I have no army, but you will leave because it's the right thing to do." I mean, his power was not the power of force, like typically, you know, we witness so often in the world, the military force or force of fear or all those kinds of things. His was genuine power of the idea, of the inspiration, of a higher vision.
Yes.
Love being with organizations where we don't spend any time complaining about the way things are. We spend our time saying, how do we want it to be? What's the next quality of way of being in community that we want to create together? What would that look like?
And that is the new paradigm. That is the way to be looking at what we can co-create together.
Yeah.
And such a different way of looking at it, rather than like full circle here when you were mentioning that people say, this is happening because of this person or that person or this situation or whatever. But if we just turn the ship around, so to speak, and head into the sunshine, it may seem like a fluffy term, but we are powerful, powerful beings. And that's not power over each other. It's a gentle power. It's a deep knowing of who we truly are. And that's the message that I'm hoping in my life that I can impart on others is the beautiful divine energy and being that we truly are.
Well, I've learned the power of intention, and so what that requires is being able to see in your mind's eye what it is you want to create. I'm reminded that in the Dead Sea Scrolls that they found in the Middle East, in one of those scrolls it asks the message, how do miracles happen? And in this scroll that's more than 2,000 years old, it says, well, if you want to create a miracle, two actions are necessary. One is to see in your mind's eye what you want to create. The second is to feel what it would feel like to have that show up in your life. If you put the seeing and the feeling together, miracles will happen. So people, you know, say to me that this intention stuff is New Age thinking. I says, well, this New Age thinking has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
It was in scrolls that were 2,000 years old. So.
Well, I really want to thank you, Ted. We've come to the end of our time. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could tell people how to reach you on your website and get that wonderful book.
Yeah, thank you, Jeannie. It's my website is peacebeginswithme.ca, and as Jeannie said, there is a link there to sign up for my newsletter. I've been doing a newsletter once a month for 4 years now. There's an archive of those newsletters if you want to go back and see what I've written over the years. And then there's a place to order my book, and I've got it as a hardcover book. I've got it as an audio book for those that prefer that, as an electronic book, and then I've got a DVD of an hour and a half presentation of the ideas and strategies about how to live, how to be peace begins with me.
Wonderful. And, you know, as we're looking at this piece that Martin Luther King said and the difference he made, you're making that difference as well, Ted. Mm-hmm. You're a big inspiration to me. And I hope that as I move through my life, that I'm able to find complete peace and stay focused with that intention. I'm certainly trying. So I want to thank you for all the work that you do on behalf of everyone, because when you shine a light, that light can be...
match in the tunnel. Yeah.
You betcha. It's like that match in the tunnel.
And
so
Jeannie, thank you for what you're doing. You're helping to shift the consciousness of the planet, and thank you for all that you're doing.
Oh, you're welcome, and it's been a real pleasure, and I hope we see each other very soon.
Me too.
Okay. Thank you, Ted.
Thanks, Jeannie.
Good night. And thank you all for listening tonight, The Creative Field. My next guest in 2 weeks will be Leslie McIntosh, who is a clinical hypnotherapist and the owner of Coastal Academy of Hypnotic Arts and Science. And she's going to come and talk to us about the mind and how we can free ourselves up of some of those things that are holding us back from our highest and our best. So thank you all for listening, and I'll see you again in 2 weeks at 8 o'clock on Sunday night. Thanks very much. Good night for now.